a joint investigation was pursued by the Henderson Police Department, as well as the Clark County Department of Family Services, Child Protective Services. During the course of the investigation, the child, or then adult, who had alleged to be the victim of sexual abuse, made a disclosure to the Henderson Police Detective, as well as the Child Protective Services representative who was investigating the matter. As a result of that, a petition was filed with the juvenile court seeking protection of the remaining minor child in the home.
What happened with the criminal investigation?
As a result of the 18-year-old's age, a deference was provided to the young lady who made the disclosure, giving her the option of pursuing criminal charges or not. She chose not to file criminal charges.
Okay.
So the only case pending before any judicial department was the Child Protective Services case within the Juvenile Division of the Judicial District Court. As a result of the petition being filed, parents entered denials. There were allegations in the petition relative to both parents, sexual abuse allegations against the father and stepfather of the person who was disclosing the sex abuse, the biological father of the child remaining in the home, and there were neglect allegations leveled against the mother.
So in that circumstance, what do you generally do? Remove the child from the home altogether?
No.
What is the general practice, just so I have a little background?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a determination made by the Clark County Department of Family Services when that type of investigation is pursued to determine whether or not the child can remain in the home with certain safety parameters. In this case, the department spoke to the mother, determined that the mother was protective enough at the time of the investigation, and left the child remaining in the home and required the father to move out of the home. That is not uncommon in the type of investigations that we're talking about in this case.
So they required the father to move out before there was ever a particular finding?
That's correct. It's normally a discussion with the family. The alternatives are, if you choose to remain in the home as a family, then the child may need to be placed into protective custody. Otherwise, an option is given to the father in this case, or the alleged perpetrator, to remove themselves from the child and the family home. And in this case, the father chose to remove himself, thereby leaving the child in the home.
Okay.
So, and you said the allegations again, we're trying to get everybody's names right. I won't repeat the names, but you said there were allegations against the natural father and the stepfather.
I'm sorry, he is the biological father of the minor child remaining right in the home. He is the stepfather of the child or young adult.
I understand. Thank you for clarifying that.
I apologize for that. So, as a result of the investigation, a petition was filed with the juvenile court, as the court is aware, that proceeded to an adjudicatory hearing. At the time of the adjudicatory hearing, a number of witnesses testified, and the error that we believe the district court made was excluding certain evidence that came in by way of testimony through the Henderson detective. As the brief indicates, we believe that District Court Judge Frank Sullivan erroneously determined that the disclosure to the Henderson Police Detective, as well as the CPS investigator, was hearsay and wrongfully excluded that evidence. We believe that Crowley versus State gives guidance in this matter, and that once the alleged victim made a disclosure to the police, that her statements, once she chose not to repeat those on the stand, became prior and consistent statements and were admissible evidence, both for substantive issues as well as for impeachment purposes. Additionally, the matter was heard before a hearing master, and at the direction of the Judicial District Court, that hearing master made very specific findings of fact, determinations on credibility as to the witnesses. As a result of her determination, the petition was sustained. The district court became involved when the respondent father, in this case, or the alleged perpetrator, filed an objection, at which time Judge Sullivan made certain determinations.
Let's go back to, we have the testimony of, is it pronounced Imani?
Imani, yeah.
Imani?
Yes.
She testified, and her not remembering having made, I gather, these statements, was she confronted at the time and ask if she had ever made this statement, opposed to just did she recall?
I believe...
I'm trying to gather what was presented to her during her time on the stand, because quite often what you do is you have a witness and they don't remember. You then put the various statements and ask her if she recalls or not, so that if she doesn't, you've made those representations, opposed to just letting the person say, I don't recall, and then trying to come in under some other exception.
Yes, sir. My recollection is that she was then questioned relative to her statement, what she indicated she could not recall or remember, her prior statement to the police officer, then she was questioned further relative to that information. I do not believe that she was ever approached with a copy of a police report or something from documentary evidence to try to refresh her recollection.
I guess reading the district court judge's order and saying there was a lack of corroboration, so to speak, I'm looking at 432B533, which talks about may allow in all relevant material evidence, and also considering the testimony of Dr. Polanski in terms of the whole issue of credibility and what to allow in and what not to, even with the hearing officer's order. What's your comment on that?
Again, Your Honor, I believe that the expert who testified was thoroughly impeached as to her position relative to the child and the young lady's diagnosis. I'm sorry, I keep referring to her as child. She was 18. And her diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder. The determination by the hearing master, I believe, was correct in assessing the witness's testimony during the hearing. She showed proper emotion during different periods of time, as was evident during the investigation and testified to by the police officer. When the issue of sex abuse came up, she appropriately cried, she was remorseful, she was anxious. Those issues were addressed to the hearing master. As argued in the brief, Judge Sullivan did not have access to a transcript. I cannot tell Your Honors whether or not he reviewed the videotape, but he does not reference reviewing the DVD. That is common practice within the family courtroom.
So what was the basis of his decision, to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, it's based solely on the pleading, Your Honor. I do not have any indication that a DVD was produced to the district court by way of these proceedings at the time that he issued his decision.
I notice in his decision he talks about the preponderance of the evidence and all. Is that the correct standard of review?
It is for the proceedings at the adjudicatory hearing stage.
Okay.
So, yes, the preponderance would have been the standard at that point.
Mm-hmm. So that's just whether to uphold or not uphold the hearing officer's findings.
Actually, the standard of proof at the time of the adjudicatory hearing in front of the hearing master is preponderance of the evidence. At the time that the objection is filed before the district court judge, the district court judge, pursuant to NRCP Rule 52, is supposed to determine whether or not the hearing master was clearly erroneous in making the determinations that they made. Here we've argued that the hearing master was not clearly erroneous based on the weight of the evidence, the witnesses that they heard, the credibility issues that were addressed, and the specific written findings of fact issued by that hearing master.
Well, in making that determination of whether it's clearly erroneous, is it a substantial evidence inquiry or preponderance of the evidence to support the findings?
I believe the district court would have the same standard.
Same standard as the hearing.
Preponderance of the evidence, Your Honor.
Well, we're kind of interested because our standard is on a bench trial is if there's substantial evidence and it's not clearly erroneous, then we have to affirm the Supreme Court reviewing a district court decision. So that we had kind of a discussion about that preponderance is a little different than substantial evidence than like that. So but if both sides concede that's the standard, it's preponderance from the hearing master's standpoint and it's clearly erroneous from the district judge's point of view. From opposing counsel to see if he agrees, then at least we can proceed accordingly.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, that is our understanding. That's what we were operating under when we made the respective arguments.
Okay.
So in addition to the issues of the hearsay and in RCP Rule 52. We also addressed to court specific language within the district court order that was concerning. The court intimated that there was some need to have corroborating evidence in addition to the disclosure made by the young lady. What we submitted to the court was an analysis of Crawford and Sixth Amendment, because Judge Sullivan appeared to be arguing that there was some sort of denial of a right to a fair trial or the ability to cross-examine effectively the witness. In this case, the state was precluded by the way that the witness who disclosed the sex abuse from actually having the facts presented. And so our argument was that there was no denial of due process, there was no denial of a right to a fair trial, and in fact, the state was precluded by way of the testimony from the victim of actually having truthful information provided. And the only way to provide that to the court was by way of bringing in the outside witnesses, the detective, the CPS worker. And in fact, the parents also testified in this matter and corroborated most of the information relative to the circumstances of the wrestling incident that you may know was actually admitted to by the respondent. He actually made a statement.
Well, he also indicated it was accidental.
He did.
And that was kind of a consensus among the family that it was accidental.
And the circumstances of that disclosure are, again, the child or the young lady at that time was being confronted by the grandmother and the family with the perpetrator in the room. Circumstances that usually lead a child to say that they believe it's an accident. I think if you look at the circumstances of the family's reaction, bringing the family meeting together, the circumstances suggest it was more than an accident. And the father, the respondent in this matter, indicated that he may have accidentally touched the child over and under the clothes to the detective. That is part of the transcript. Accidental touching under the clothes, very questionable, Your Honors. I would like to reserve my remaining time.
Thank you. Mr. Grigsby?
Definitely, Your Honor. It's Aaron Grigsby representing both of the respondents in this matter. And we'd like to start off by saying that it's our position that District Court Judge Frank Sullivan had ample grounds to decline to affirm the recommendations of the hearing master. And not only did he have the grounds to do it, he had the ability to do it under NRCP 52. NRCP 52 doesn't we actually differ from the state. We don't believe it requires the clearly erroneous standard of review. It allows the district court to either adopt the findings of facts of the recommendations, findings of fact of any court master in whole or part, or to dismiss them totally.
So you're saying it's a de novo review by the district court, then?
Yes, Your Honor. And if the district court decides that it wants to not adopt whatever findings of fact that it doesn't want to adopt as part of its order, then that just leaves it just a pure preponderance of the evidence standard. And if it doesn't adopt a specific finding of fact, it doesn't have to find any of the findings of fact clearly erroneous. Now, additionally, as far as we differ from the state with some of the on its recitation of some of the facts, the young adult in question, who was about 19, probably almost going on 20 about the time this petition was filed, actually testified at court that the actual abuse part never happened.
Now, that was before the hearing officer, or was there a separate hearing before
that was before the
Sullivan?
That was before the hearing master.
Okay, yeah.
The state called her as their witness. She testified that it didn't happen. She does vaguely remember, upon prompting the meeting with Detective Swartwood and Kim and the CPS investigator. I guess what I would contend to the court is the state wasn't denied their opportunity to present truthful evidence and testimony to the court. We've all put on witnesses who we thought were going to say one thing and said something else. It's just a matter of what we deal with as litigating attorneys. They put her on. She didn't say what they wanted them to say. And so what they want to do at that time is bring in testimony from, instead of following up with that witness, trying to refresh her recollection. They want to bring in the Detective Swartwood and the CPS investigator, Kim Artis, and bring the testimony in, not just as impeachment evidence, but as substantive evidence. And it's our position that their testimony was essentially hearsay, not subject to any exception. And just Sullivan agreed with that assertion. And additionally,
but his prior inconsistent statements, why wouldn't they be admissible under 432B 530?
Your Honor, it's our position, 432B 530, I'm assuming you're referring to Section 3.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And when we look at the legislative history from AB 199, well, actually, just on the plain
face. Was it ambiguous?
Well, actually, just on the plain face of the statute. The statute says that the district court may, and uses discretionary language, may entertain oral or written reports to, if they're relevant, to the extent of probative value. Now, the state has argued, and we say in their opening brief, by submitting the legislative history and referring to it, that they're trying to say it's ambiguous. I would say, given that the hearing master Duffy ruled upon one of our objections that, according to 432B 530 subsection 3, that the rules of evidence don't apply. So I guess I would argue that it's ambiguous because she's clearly got a different reading from that statute than I did by reading it. And this is why I refer to the legislative history. And legislative history, it's designed to allow physicians, to not tie up physicians in rural counties, to allow the reports to be admitted without tying up a physician in a rural county. And from section 60 of AB 199, that's what, that's the reading that we would submit to the course of proper reading, and that's what's allowed, is for those reports by physicians to come in, physicians, therapists. It doesn't eviscerate the rules of evidence. And since these matters involve a fundamentally protected constitutional interest, the right to parent, I would submit to the court that the rules of evidence, that to the extent possible, we should be following them as closely as possible to ensure that due process is granted to these parents who are being deprived of the company of their child. And additionally, Judge Sullivan also made the ruling that the hearing master Duffy's decision was based entirely on the hearsay statements of those Detective Swartwood and Kim Artis. And if the district court judge declined to adopt their statements as part of his findings of fact, it's our position that he was entirely appropriate and declined not to sign a recommendation and finding that the subject minor was not a child in need of protection. The state could either deny that they could have done more to go after the subject matter, to go after their witness, who was not a party to this case. And I believe they conceived that there was, absent a finding that 432B 530 subsection 3 applied in this matter, that there's no other rules of evidence or procedure that would allow her testimony to be admissible. The testimony of Detective Swartwood and Kim Artis. And I guess we would also submit that, the district court couldn't make the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause argument, but given the fundamental interests that are at stake, that maybe those things should apply. The due process provisions.
This is not a criminal proceeding. It may be quasi, but it's not a criminal proceeding, and thus far the court hasn't looked to extend the Crawford to this. We seem to have some comment in the record in terms of due process and trying to afford that in this. But we've talked about the first half of the 432B. The second half is a little troubling as I get into it, because we start with all relevant material evidence helpful in determining the question. And it goes on, the parties or their attorneys must be afforded an opportunity to examine and controvert written reports so received and to cross-examine individuals making reports when reasonably available. And I guess the question within the lines is, were these reports attacked or were these reports examined when they were before the hearing officer?
And Your Honor, the reports were never admitted as evidence. It was just the testimony. And yes, the testimony of Detective Swartwood was attacked. We have Detective Swartwood in conveniently and strangely. And Detective Swartwood was an experienced Henderson Police Officer sex investigator. But her interview of the young adult, the alleged victim, was not conducted within the normal standards. It was conducted, I believe, at the student union at UNLV. It wasn't recorded. And when attacked specifically about the questions that were put towards the young lady, Detective Swartwood conveniently couldn't remember exactly which questions were asked. She couldn't remember the specifics. And our argument to Judge Sullivan, we submitted that it lacked any individual addition of reliability, Detective Swartwood's statements. So although they could have come in for impeachment purposes, if he was going to grant them any probative value, it should be low, because it wasn't recorded, there wasn't anyone else there. There was no report actually written or that was admitted into evidence. So there was no other indicia of reliability and giving her failing memory on these facts. And the son was attacked for the investigator, Kim Artis, who also, I believe, conducted her interview. She said at the parking lot of In-N-Out Burgers, didn't record her interview and couldn't remember specific questions upon cross-examination.
Counsel for the state has indicated that she's not aware of whether or not Judge Sullivan had an opportunity to review the tape recording of the proceedings. Is your recollection of whether he had or had not when he heard the objections to the hearing officer's decision, if you made any reference to what he relied upon?
My recollection differs from that of the state. I recall Judge Sullivan during our argument session specifically stating that he reviewed the tape of the hearing, which is common. Which is usually his common practice is to review these. And given this, some of the specific findings he made upon and questions he asked during our argument phase of it, I believe that he would have had to have reviewed it. But although I didn't attach transcripts as part of my opinions to Judge Sullivan's hearing.
No, this wasn't. Okay.
And so I'm just noting that for the record that. So this is kind of outside the scope of what we presented to the court. But I recall Judge Sullivan actually saying that, as making the comment that he reviewed the tape as part when we were arguing the objection before him.
And he certainly could review the tape since there's no court reporter, recorder, and family division. So you have to really look at the videotapes to. We do as well when we're reviewing the record on these cases. Then, so that's your recollection that he inferred that he did look at them to come to the conclusions that he did.
Yes, actually, I recall him saying it, but also know it's his normal practice. But I guess I could also infer based on the questions he asked us and some of the statements he made during our arguments. But I did not think to attach that as part of my appendix. And once again, the district court properly could refuse to sign the order. And also another point I'd like to make is that the state seems to have a contradictory argument going. On one hand, they argued that essentially Judge Sullivan shouldn't be allowed to decline to sign the recommendations because he's not the person who, you know, was there, heard the evidence personally and saw the body language of the victim, of the people who were testifying. But then on the other hand, they're essentially arguing that the court should be allowed to sustain substantiate one of these petitions based solely on witnesses that, the testimony of witnesses that don't have first-hand knowledge of the events. Now, and so to me, their premise is a little contradictory, in the version of having your cake and eating it too. So I guess what we should try to set out in our moving papers is that the court, you know, had the ability to do decline to sign the recommendations, and was proper in declining to sign the recommendations because they weren't based on. I mean, especially if he declines to accept the findings of the hearing master, they weren't based on any substantial evidence. All they were based on was essentially hearsay statements. That's all they presented. And most of the hearsay, the reasoning for the young lady's failing memory, I believe that was adequately explained by Dr. Pulaski in her diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, her explanations of some of the, you know, since the young lady was being was untreated at the time that she made these alleged statements, Dr. Pulaski aptly set out, you know, that could have explained any failures in the young lady's memory.
The hearing officer makes a point in her findings to talk about Dr. Pulaski and her lack of familiarity in this particular subset. Do you have any comment as to that?
She said that Dr. Pulaski may not have been, she may not have put her information together in the best order, the order I would prefer. But Dr. Pulaski's, I mean, her statements were uncontroverted, and her credentials, she was qualified to make the diagnosis.
Please, can you respond?
She was qualified to make the diagnosis that she made. So essentially what the hearing master was stating is that she just didn't believe Dr. Pulaski's testimony that the young lady's memory could have been affected by this diagnosis and by diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, or that it could explain away any of the statements that she was alleged to have made.
Anything additional? Thank you, Mr. Frisbee. Mr. Cordes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, a point apparently is whether or not Judge Sullivan had the ability to review the DVD. I think he had the ability. I did not remember or recollect him saying that he actually reviewed that at the time that he rendered his decision. His written decision does not reflect the fact that he took time to review the DVD or go over it. And so the other point that was made during the brief was that even if, assuming he did look at the DVD, the camera only focuses on the individual who is speaking, does not focus on the other individuals in the courtroom. And in this case, it's specifically concerning because the mother and the perpetrator were in the courtroom while the child or young lady revealed the sex abuse or could not recall the sexual abuse statements that she had made. And so without the ability to observe all of the witnesses, the parties' behaviors that may affect the witness testimony, it would not be the best evidence for Judge Sullivan to rely on by just reviewing the DVD and not giving due credit to the hearing master's personal perceptions of all of the parties and witnesses during the time of the testimony. As it relates to 530, there were no written reports admitted, but there were oral reports admitted. And we believe, pursuant to 432B 530, those oral reports are admissible evidence.
and should have been considered by the district court as they were by the hearing master who made the decision in this matter. And the police officer did specifically recall the interview, testified in detail as to where the interview transpired, what happened, and Imani's demeanor during the course of that interview. She was had the ability to be cross-examined by Mr. Grigsby, and she was subjected to that. Given all that information, the hearing master still determined that that information was credible, admissible, and sufficient to establish preponderance of evidence and sustain this petition. We believe that legal grounds exist and ask the court to reverse and remand this case.
Can I talk to Justice Douglas about the standard review again, Mr. Cordes? Yes. We'll kind of go through it because it's when we have a reversal, it's kind of unusual when getting those. I think Mr. Grigsby's right, though, as far as the district court on a hearing master's recommendations generally can accept them, reject them, or adopt part of them. That's what the rule is for discovery commissioners and everybody else. So then the question comes, our review at that stage here, and then would is that where Rule 52 and 53 together would come into play at that stage? And when we have to decide what standard do we apply in reviewing Judge Sullivan's decision to reject them?
Okay, and I agree that the specific wording in RCP 52 does give the district court the discretion to accept part of it, all of it, or discount the entire finding. The problem is the district court has to review those and accept part of them, dismiss them, based on that clearly erroneous standard, not just say, heard the testimony and I'm sorry, the hearing master was wrong and I'm going to discount all of these. There has to be some standard that the district court judge utilizes, and I think the statute specifically says clearly erroneous. So as you review District Court Judge Sullivan's determination, he does not set forth why the hearing master's determinations that he accepted or did not accept in whole were clearly erroneous. He just says that allowing in the hearsay was clearly erroneous, which I submit, Your Honor, pursuant to Crawley, is not correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions, Your Honor?
No, not at this time.
Thank you.
What I would like to do, at least initially, is Mr. Grigsby, within 10 days, I'd like you to supplement the record by submitting the DVD from the family court from the hearing before Judge Sullivan when he reviewed the hearing master's finding. I will give the court an opportunity to review that and the basis, since we have a lack of clear recollection and it's important enough to understand what he did or didn't do, or whether or not we're still stuck in the same quagmire that we started with today. Thank both counsel for their arguments. This is important as we try to enhance our case law dealing with the family court. This matter will stand submitted subject to the filing of that DVD.